This evening, we welcome guest speaker Dr. Stanley Monteith, a retired orthopedic surgeon, a researcher, historian, an author, a lecturer, and a talk show host. Dr. Monteith has educated audiences both nationally and internationally on a wide variety of subjects. Just to mention a few, foundations, their power and influence, and AIDS, the unnecessary epidemic, and numerous other geopolitical issues. He is considered to be one of our nation's leading experts on the life and the writings of Professor Carol Quigley, President Clinton's mentor and teacher. Additionally, he has spent 30 years researching the causes for America's spiritual and moral decline. Tonight, Dr. Monteith will be discussing the subject of population control and how the covert policies of America's unelected rulers have fostered a program of genocide throughout the world during this past century. It is his contention that current American policies have brought both death and destruction to much of the world on a scale that dwarfs the magnitude of the Jewish Holocaust of World War II. He believes that only by understanding the true motivation and spiritual forces behind those who support such policies can we hope to survive as a free nation. And now, without further delay, please join me in a nice warm welcome for Dr. Stanley Monteith.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening and enjoying your Southern California weather here. It's nice. We've been having a lot of bad weather up in Northern California. I wanted to start this talk this evening with a story I've told before, but it's a story that is so apropos to what's going on in America today. You see, the tragedy is most people really don't understand what's happening in our society. And of course, this is really nothing new, because 2,400 years ago, a Greek philosopher wrote a story about what was happening to the glory that had been Greece. And at that time, sophistry was at its flower. It was a method of arguing a false point to the point where people came to believe it. And so he wrote this allegory for the Greek people to explain to them what was happening to their nation. And it was the story of a group of men and women who'd been taken captive. And they'd been taken into this gigantic cavern, where for many years they were kept and chained. Chained so that their faces were towards the wall of the cavern, and behind them in the center of the cavern there burned an eternal fire. Now, at times their captors, to amuse themselves, would project shadows on the wall of the cave from that fire. But you see, all the people in their chains, all the prisoners could see, was simply the dancing shadows projected on the wall of the cave. And at times, those figures would be terrifying. They'd be horrifying figures, and they'd be fearsome, and they'd look very evil. And those shadows became their reality, and the people would cry out in terror. And at other times, the shadows would be humorous faces projected upon the wall of the cave, and that was their reality. And for all the many years, they remained in the cave. All they saw were the dancing shadows projected upon the wall of the cave. And then one day one of their group broke loose from his chains and went outside the cavern, and he saw reality. He saw the sun and the stars and the brooks and the trees, and he went back into the cavern and broke his fellows loose from their chains and tried to lead them out to reality. But as they approached the light coming in through the mouth of the cave, they were blinded. And so they turned back, because you see, their reality had become simply dancing shadows projected upon the wall of the cave. Now, that story was written by Plato, and it's in his Republic. If you've ever taken Philosophy 1A, you read it. And yet it's so true. It's exactly what's happening in America today, because most people have no concept of what's really is transpiring in our society. Plato believed that democracy didn't work. And so he wanted a ruling aristocracy. He wanted a ruling group, a ruler who would rule the whole world. And that indeed is what's happening today. In fact, if you read the writings of the people we are going to be talking about this evening, they want exactly what Plato wanted 2,400 years ago, and that is a world ruling elite ruling over a very small population throughout the world. Now, I debated what I would talk to you about this evening. I initially thought maybe we'd talk about secret societies or Carol Quigley or geopolitics. But I think probably the most important single thought that I can leave with you here in Southern California is the thought that there is an organized effort to depopulate the world. Now, ordinarily, if you tell people about secret societies, they sort of shrug. If you tell them about the fact that we went into Vietnam, purely for political purposes, we never intended to win, people will shrug. We tell them about the boys we left behind, but who really cares? Until we can convince people that their own lives, the lives of their families, the lives of their loved ones are at stake, they're not going to be concerned. And so I wanted to share with you an incredible, incredible story. It was Daniel Webster who said, "There's nothing as powerful as truth, but often nothing as strange." And Lord Byron who said, "'Tis strange but true, for truth is always strange, stranger than fiction." I was doing a television program in the South a few years ago and we were talking about the AIDS epidemic in Africa, and really what is happening there is something beyond the comprehension of the average individual, because you're not really being told what's happening in Africa. And as I was talking, the host, Pastor Jimmy Thompson, who owned the television station, his eyes kept getting bigger and bigger. And after we'd gone off camera, he looked at me in stark amazement, and he said, "That explains it." And I said, "Explains what?" He said, the monument over there in Georgia. And I said, "What monument in Georgia?" And so he told me about a monument in Georgia, an occult, demonic monument in a little town called Elberton, Georgia. I had to see it. And if you drive east from Atlanta on I-85 and you turn south just before you get to the South Carolina border and you go about 50 miles south, you come to a little town called Elberton. And you talk to people in town about the monument and they sort of look at you because they all know there's something a little strange about that monument. Now, some of them like the monument and they think it's good for tourism, but others there, especially those who are Christians, are a little wary of the monument. They don't tell you very much other than they tell you how to get there. They may try to feel you out and find out whether you're a Christian or whether you're one of those people from the other side. You drive up Highway 77 about 6 or 7 miles out of Albert, and there it is on the top of a hill. These great, massive granite stones, patterned somewhat after the Stonehenge in England, that ancient Druid monument that's there. And you can see there on 8 different languages, in English and Russian and Hebrew and Hindi and Spanish and Swahili and Chinese and Arabic, you can find 10 commandments. They call them 10 guides, but the counterpart of the 10 commandments of the Bible. And then up on the top, there's this gigantic capstone, and there in 4 more languages, and hieroglyphics, and Sanskrit, and Babylonian cuneiform, and classic Greek, is another message. It says, "Let these guidestones be guidestones to an age of reason. Let these be the guidestones to an age of reason." Now, how many of you here know what the age of reason is, and who wrote it? And I don't see too many hands going up. How many of you? There's a gentleman who knows the age of reason. A couple of people know what it is. I had to know, so I went to the local library, got the file out, and it was an amazing file. Talked about the background of the Guidestones, how a lot of people wondered if this could be a center of cult worship. Other people thought that maybe it was just a wonderful thing. It was giving mankind a key to the future. Talked about the UFO that was seen circling over the Guidestones back there in 1980, just after it had been created. Talked about an interview with the mayor, Joe Findlay, and he said, "Well, you know, there have been a lot of occult things going out there, you know, occult ceremonies and naked dancing, but there's been some Christian things going on too, even a Christian wedding." And then it told about the energy forces that were centered there and the tradition which most people in Elberton really believe, and that is that at the very day that the Guidestones were dedicated after everybody had gone home, a witch named Jody was said to have gone to her van and taken off all of her clothes, put on a purple hooded gown, and walked up the top of the hill, and then standing there with the wind whipping the black hair over her face, and watched the approach of a white hawk, and then walked around the guidestones and made a circle around them and then put a pentagram on every one of the guidestones. And you read this and what in heaven's name is this all about? But that's the tradition of the Georgia guidestones and their message for humanity today. Well, for many, many years, for over a decade, I led the battle within organized medicine in California to try to address the AIDS epidemic as an epidemic. And it didn't seem to matter what the doctors of this state, or of any other state for that matter, felt was good to save human lives. There was an organized effort to block implementation of the public health policies that are necessary to save human lives. Now, I want to tell you five things about the epidemic. First of all, contrary to everything you've heard, there is no AIDS epidemic. Secondly, there is an epidemic that is so disastrous and unbelievable it is difficult for most of you sitting here in the comfort of your chairs here at the Granada Forum to really fathom. Thirdly, doctors know how to stop the epidemic. Fourth, there is an organized effort to block implementation of those policies. And lastly, that this is part of a massive program aimed at depopulating the earth. Now, right at this point, I don't expect you to believe a thing I've said. But I hope before you finish the evening, perhaps you'll begin looking at the world through the same eyes, and perhaps those dancing shadows on the wall of the cave will cease to be a reality, and you begin to see what is really going on, and you begin to see how everything that is happening in society is part of a long-range plan. And believe me, there is an agenda. Well, when I say there is no AIDS epidemic, a lot of people sort of, they smile. I mean, what do you mean there's no AIDS epidemic? I mean, everybody knows there's an AIDS epidemic. If you look over there in the back table, somebody has a book called Why We'll Never Win the War on AIDS by Brian Ellison. And Brian Ellison points out in that book that there are people who are qualified as having AIDS and they're not HIV infected. So how can HIV be the cause of AIDS? And after all, what is AIDS? It's an acquired immunodeficiency syndrome made up of a group of some 20 different diseases, which we've had for many, many years. And that's already very true. AIDS is simply a term that was invented to confuse the public. The disease is HIV disease. It's a chronic disease associated with severe immunodeficiency. And at the end stage of that disease, your immune system collapses and you develop any one of a number of diseases, one of them pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, an organism that is right here surrounding every one of us in this room, but we're not going to get the disease because we have a normal immune system. But when your immune system collapses, you become susceptible to it. The trouble is that by CDC definition, if you have pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, whether you have HIV disease or not, you're categorized as AIDS. Why? Simply to confuse the issue and allow Brian Ellison to write a book entitled Why We'll Never Win the War on AIDS. In Africa, some of the cases there do not have HIV infection, and yet they have a severe immunodeficiency. In America, the incidence of severe immunodeficiency without HIV infection is about 0.02%. It's just a fraction of a very small fraction of a percent. In the years before the HIV virus was introduced into our society, we would have 5 to 6 cases of pneumocystis carinii pneumonia occurring spontaneously in the entire nation, other than the cases which were related to the chemotherapeutic agents that are used in cancer therapy. We have a new entity, but it's not AIDS, it's HIV disease, and we use the term HIV only to confuse the public. Dr. Peter Duisberg has written a book, Inventing the AIDS Virus. Dr. Duisberg says there is no epidemic. Now, why would Dr. Duisberg say that? He's one of the world's leading experts, a retrovirologist. And we can discuss, if any of you have any questions on Dr. Peter Duisberg's position, that there is no epidemic. Let me explain to you, I've debated Dr. Duisberg. He will not go into a platform with me any more than Brian Ellison will. But there's some people who believe we never put a man on the moon. Now, most of you here probably believe that we really did land a man on the moon and that this was not a stage trick. But if Buzz Aldrin was to come before you tonight and say it was already true, we didn't put a man on the moon at all, you'd say, well, gee, maybe there's some possibility that's the case. And when Peter Duisberg, a world-renowned retrovirologist, gets up and makes a lot of statements that have no basis in truth at all, he can create dancing shadows on the wall, the cave. And so we have a conscious effort to confuse the public. Is there an epidemic? Dr. Duisberg says there's not. But almost everybody else who's ever studied it says there is, and there are 350,000 dead Americans, who most of whom have died of this severe immunodeficiency, another 200,000 who are in the process of dying, another 600,000 to 1 million in Americans who are dying or have not yet progressed to the terminal stage of disease. We have a major epidemic, and yet we have books like Michael Fumento's The Myth of Heterosexual AIDS. Michael Fumento, and it's interesting that the same publisher, at least related to the same publisher, Regnery, Gateway published Michael Fumento, and Inventing the AIDS Virus was published by Regnery. Is there perhaps a purpose behind this whole effort to confuse the public? 3 or 4 years ago, most people were concerned about the AIDS epidemic. Today, most people are really unconcerned about the AIDS epidemic. We've just sort of taken it for granted. Most talk shows aren't interested in covering it anymore. After all, don't we have a treatment for it? Don't we have maybe a cure? Dr. Ho on the front page of Time magazine within the last few weeks there named a man of the year because he'd come up with a treatment or a cure or come up with something. And let me tell you, it is miraculous what's happened to many of the patients who had severe immunodeficiency, and are now it's almost like they're coming back from death. But you see, in other countries, they don't have $15,000 to $20,000 a year to put out in medication. In Africa today, 90% of the army of Zimbabwe is now infected, and they're all going to die. They've already lost in Zimbabwe between a quarter and a third of the government officials within the cabinet of the nation. In South Africa, 25% of minors are infected, and by the turn of the century, 25% of the population will be infected, and they're all going to die because we can't possibly afford to take care of them. An article that appeared in May of this year in Special Warfare magazine. Now, this is put out by the JFK Center for Warfare. The magazine is circulated only among elite military units. It's not circulated among the public because there are certain things that you're not to know. But in this article by Professor Brian Sullivan, he talks about what AIDS holds for Africa. And he comments that within the next 10 to 15 years, by special circumstances, almost all of the armies of all of Africa will be infected with the virus. Right now, 50% of all members of all the armies of Africa are infected. But within 10 to 15 years, they will all be infected, and they will all die, as well as the members of the government will all die. They are expecting hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people to die. Now, you would think that this was an official government publication published by the Superintendent of Documents of the United States, that this would be mentioned by Time magazine and Life magazine and Newsweek magazine and USA News and World Report. This is an epidemic of biblical proportions. Let me put this into something you can understand. If a 747 goes down and everybody on board is killed, headlines in every newspaper. And yet, you would have to imagine that if 1 billion people were to die, 25 million 747s would have to go down, and everybody on board would be killed. But we're not even talking about that, because you see your reality are those dancing shadows on the wall of the cave. India is beginning to become the epicenter of this epidemic in one town, and you get this out of the Harvard's AIDS Review, and if you get copies of our population control agenda, much of what I'm telling you is referenced there. We can tell you the sources of the reference. In India, in one city, 25% of housewives with no recognizable risk sources are now infected. They're talking about 10,000 people a day dying, every day dying of this disease in India by the turn of the century. And how are we fighting the epidemic? Well, the only way at this stage to stop the epidemic would be a vaccine. And of course, a vaccine could be used, and you don't even have to give people a killed vaccine. You can genetically engineer this using a GP120 from the shell of the vaccine, a GP165, where there's no danger of hurting people. And so what have we done? Why, we set millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in developing vaccines, and we've just stopped all vaccine research as of June of 1994. And we have a free copy of an article out of the New York Times for those of you who would like to look at it. 2 days after that came out in the New York Times, 3 days, a similar article appeared in the Wall Street Journal. We've just stopped all vaccine research. Why? Oh, well, we just don't want to put the money out. We really want to come up with a cure. We've never cured the common cold, and you mean we're going to cure this virus? Well, it's too expensive to try to stop the spread of the disease. We'll just go ahead and treat the millions, the hundreds of millions, the billions of people as they die. And, of course, the estimate that I've given you from Special Warfare magazine is not alone. Professor Hazeltine, professor of both pathology and public health at Harvard University, two professorships, gave a talk to the French Academy of Science back in November of 1992, gave almost the same exact estimates, totally blacked out by the controlled media in the United States. And then, of course, I say that doctors know how to stop this epidemic. There's no AIDS epidemic, it's an HIV epidemic. The HIV epidemic is so far worse than anything you've ever thought of or imagined in your worst nightmares. Now, what you have to understand is you're not probably going to get this disease because the virus we have here in the United States is entirely different than the type that they have loosened in Africa and Asia. We have subtype B, which is very difficult to infect heterosexual white people. Blacks, much easier to, in fact, there's about a 10 times incidence of black over white. And of course, the blacks in America know that this is a disease that is aimed at them, and they believe that the whites hate them and are allowing it to happen. And you know, it's not that the average white hates blacks at all, but do we really care? Or is it their problem? Like we say, it's the homosexuals' problem, the IV drug users' problem. Every human being is a unique individual made in the image and likeness in God, and we should be concerned about everybody, whether they're in this country or in any other country. And the fact that we're not doing anything to stop this epidemic, and we know how, is almost unbelievable. Now, how do you stop an epidemic? Well, very simply, you identify who has the disease and you prevent them from giving it to others. That's what we should have done early on in the disease, when we only had a few tens of thousands of people infected. Back in 1985, we had a wonderful blood test. It was incredibly accurate. We could have tested the entire population of the United States for about $500 million and stopped the epidemic at that time. But we were told, oh, you can't do that. It's just too expensive. It could lead to discrimination. We'll just drive the disease underground if we try to find out who has the disease and stop its spread. We're going to stop this education with education. We're going to pass out free condoms. We're going to pass out 10% bleach solution to all IV drug users. You notice we don't hear much about that anymore, the bleach solution now, and they want to give out free needles. Well, the reason they don't get out of the 10% bleach anymore is because it never worked. For 7 years in America, a nation where they could send a man to the moon and a space probe to Mars, nobody ever took 10% bleach and put it in a syringe to find out if it worked. And when they finally did, 7 years later, they said, whoops, doesn't work. Well, too bad all those people died. But after all, they were only IV drug users. Now they're giving out free needles. Well, there's not one study that shows that this works. In fact, the only study is in Montreal where it showed that they got three times as much HIV disease in the people they distributed the free needles to. And they said that must have been an aberration. But it should work, so this is how we're going to push efforts to stop the epidemic. Well, the first thing you need to do is identify who has the disease, test the general population, routine testing in doctor's offices and in hospitals, and then mandatory reportability of the disease to public health officers so we'll have some idea how much disease there is. Number two, so certainly you can get these people into treatment. A third, so you can do contact tracing, find out who gave the disease to the patient and who they gave it to. And lastly, sort of for that small group that are intentionally spreading this disease, they shouldn't be quarantined. They'd be in prison for the rest of their life because you do not, in a civilized society, allow people to kill other people except with one disease, and that's HIV disease, because most of the people who are getting it are homosexuals and IV drug users and blacks, and that's unconscionable. Now, next we should have mandatory premarital, prenatal, and neonatal testing because this is primarily spread by sexual contact in America. And certainly it's spread from mothers to children. One of the most interesting things is that the doctors across America have repeatedly voted that they wanted mandatory neonatal testing. In other words, testing of newborn children and then notifying mothers that the child had antibodies, because that would mean mother had the antibodies, and that she would then certainly not be promiscuous should she be gotten into treatment. But they block that at every turn. We should have mandatory neonatal testing. In other words, testing of pregnant women. The American Medical Association voted that they wanted to do that in 1995. But then the leaders of organized medicine refused to do it. So the leaders of organized medicine, the members of the House of Delegates, the American Medical Association, voted again in 1996. We want to introduce mandatory neonatal testing of every pregnant woman in America to save the lives of unborn children. Why? Because now we can give mothers AZT and probably the new protease inhibitors and almost stop all transmission from mothers to their unborn children if the mother is infected. And you know what the American Medical Association, that organization dedicated to preserving your health, has done? They've appointed a committee, and the committee has decided the doctors didn't know what they were doing. And so they are refusing to carry out the directives of the doctors, but that's nothing new. Because the third thing that we need to do in stopping the epidemic is mandatory reportability to the public health officer. I led the battle with an organized medicine for 11 years here in California. And year after year, the doctors would vote to support the public health policies. And they weren't my policies. They were just sound public health that had been introduced back in 1936 by Surgeon General Thomas Perrin, how you stop a sexually transmitted disease. And the doctors would vote to do it, and the leaders of organized medicine would refuse to do it. Well, in 1993, organized medicine voted here in California to support legislation to report mandatorily to public health officer anybody who was HIV infected. So I introduced the legislation, and CMA refused to support it. So in 1995, we came back again, and this time the doctors voted to introduce legislation. In other words, the CMA was directed by the doctors of this state, the representatives, to introduce legislation to report this disease to public health officers. Well, what does CMA do? Well, they're really up against it. I mean, the doctors want to try to stop this disease. One of the most important things is mandatory reportability. What do we? We'll appoint a committee. So they appointed a committee and said the doctors really didn't know what they were doing. So they just refused to carry out the directives of the doctors. And they said, well, there's a new paper that's going to come out where they've interviewed a number of homosexuals who said that they wouldn't be treated, they wouldn't even be blood tested if they knew that their name was going to be reported to the public health officer. And then the inference is it's going to become public knowledge. Now, there's not one incident in all of the million or more cases we've reported to public health officers where that information has ever been released and publicly and resulted in discrimination. A couple of times, homosexuals have got hold of the lists and tried to publicize them, but they've always been kept private, and it's a serious crime to do that. But you see, the real reason behind this whole thing is they don't want to stop the epidemic. And the leaders within organized medicine in California and back in with the American Medical Association have an agenda which most doctors have no glimpse of. Certainly, we should try to take infected prostitutes off the streets. We ought to close down gay bathhouses and sex clubs. We ought to do everything we possibly can to try to get IV drug users into treatment rather than giving them free needles or giving them 10% bleach, which doesn't work, to irrigate out their syringes. And certainly we should have an educational program that stresses morality and abstinence and personal values and personal pride and chastity instead of passing out condoms, telling our young people to use naloxone-9, which is a spermicide, and all the studies show it increases the spread of the disease. And lastly, of course, we should have within our schools a program that tells young people about personal responsibility and how to say no. Condom distribution being pushed in America today has nothing to do with stopping the spread of HIV disease. It has to do with preserving the hedonism which has been invaded our schools and invaded our society. It is part of a religious ritual having nothing whatsoever to do with stopping this epidemic, because all of the condom studies, and we have a book that goes back into this called A Nation Deceived and Betrayed, and we just analyze every single one of the condom studies that is being, the CDC has used to demonstrate how effective they are. And even the best study they ever had was one that was done in France with not the type of virus they have in Africa, which is 100 to 500 times more communicable than the one we have in America, but done with the subtype B, which we have here, which is very hard to transmit anyway. And the study was done by Dr. DiVincenzi, and when she was contacted by a friend of mine, she said, I don't know how your Centers for Disease Control can use my study to justify their position that condoms are safe, because my study didn't come up with that conclusion. But you see, that's the study that is being used today. Now, what am I saying? I'm saying that we are going to see the greatest Holocaust ever seen throughout all recorded time, resulting from the AIDS epidemic. So let's go back and think a little bit about the Holocaust in Germany. And this comes from a book that was called One Generation After by Elie Wiesel. And she says, spring of 1946, emerging from the nightmare, the world discovers the camps, the death factories, the senseless horror, the debasement, the absolute reign of evil. Victory tastes of ashes. Yes, it's possible to defile life and creation and feel no remorse, to tend one's garden and water one's flowers, but two steps away from the barbed wire. To experiment with monstrous mutations and still believe in the soul and immortality. To go on vacation, be enthralled by the beauty of a landscape, make children laugh, and still fulfill regularly, day in and day out, the duties of a killer. There was then a technique, a science of murder, complete with specialized laboratories, business meetings, and progress charts. Those engaged in its practice didn't belong to the gutter society of misfits, nor could they be dismissed as just a collection of rabble. Many held degrees in philosophy, sociology, biology, general medicine, psychiatry, and fine arts. There were lawyers among them, and as unthinkable as it may seem, theologians. And what people do not understand is that the Holocaust did not begin in Hitler's Germany. It began in the mind of a theologian named Thomas Malthus. And Thomas Malthus was born in the mid-1700s, and he was writing his essay on population between about 1890 and about 1910. And Thomas Malthus said, you know, there's just too many people in the world. Thomas Malthus was a minister. He also held a degree. He was a professor of economic philosophy in England. And he said, there are too many people in the world. And to deal with sickness, crime, and to try to save people's lives simply aggravates the problem further. And so he condemned charity and philanthropy, international relief, development missions, outreach to help the common people. He talked about the fact that what we wanted to do was discourage cleanliness among the lower classes, because he believed, of course, in an elite class of people. But the common people, well, we shouldn't allow a child to be born and to live unless someone died, because after all, there weren't going to be enough food to feed these people. So he said, what we ought to do is discourage cleanliness. What we want to do is build our cities next to stagnant pools. What we certainly want to do is discourage anyone who wants to stop the ravages of disease. Now, Thomas Malthus was a professor, and his ideas caught hold in England. And there was a professor named Galton who wrote extensively about this in England in the mid-1800s. And these ideas had come to America shortly after the turn of the century. And they were largely financed by America's great tax-exempt foundations. The Rockefeller Foundation at that time was beginning to fund these ideas. And of course, Margaret Sanger was there, and she caught the glimpse. And by 1915, she was already beginning to open up her birth control clinics in the areas of town where there were Jews and blacks and Latins and Southern Europeans and Italians, these people unworthy of life. In 1922, she wrote her book, The Pivot of Civilization, in which she talked about the extermination of the unworthy classes and how it was necessary to segregate the misfits and the people of lower class concepts. And how really what we had to begin to sterilize those people, those inferior classes of people. This was 1922, long before Adolf Hitler came to power. Adolf Hitler and what you saw in Adolf Hitler's Germany was simply a manifestation of what was already going on in America at that time, because here in America we were already beginning to sterilize the mentally defective, those with emotional problems. In fact, it was the Rockefeller Foundation that financed the Kaiser Wilhelm Genetic Engineering Center in pre-war Germany in about 1922. So when Adolf Hitler came along, he was simply building upon what was already metastasized across the Atlantic from America to Germany. And of course, it was a very short step from abortion to going along with a program of socialized medicine. Then there wasn't enough money to pay for the care of the elderly, and they began to talk about death with dignity and those lives that were not worth living. And there was tremendous anti-Semitism within Hitler's Germany, but there was also tremendous anti-Christian feelings within Hitler's Germany. We have a fascinating book in the back called Hitler and the Third Reich. And of course, what most people do not understand is what Professor Norman Cohn writes in his book, Warrant for Genocide. He was a Jewish scholar who was trying to understand the Holocaust. And he pointed out what Martin Niemöller pointed out so beautifully in that poem. You've all heard it, or this saying that he wrote, and he said, you know, when I was in Germany, first they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, and so I wasn't concerned. And then they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, and I wasn't concerned. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, and I wasn't concerned. And then they came for the Catholics, and I was a Protestant, so I wasn't concerned. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to be concerned. And what Professor Cohen, Norman Cohen, points out is that there were twice as many non-Jews killed during this period of time as there were Jews. But you see, we never tell the American people that, because they killed an awful lot of Christians, both Catholic and Protestant, during those days, and we don't want to alarm the American people about that possibility occurring here. It was during those days in the 1930s when Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood, and of course those of you who know anything about Planned Parenthood realize that today her organization receives $250 million every year of your tax money to be used for coercive sterilization, coercive abortion in China and other countries throughout the world. And of course, the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation and the Ford Foundation all financed Planned Parenthood with your tax money. In Margaret Sanger's book, she was writing in magazines, the Birth Control Review, she was writing about how wonderful Adolf Hitler's Germany was. Of course, we don't talk about that now. She even had Ernst Rudin, R-U-D-I-N, who was the head of the Nazi experimental program where they were experimenting on human beings, come over here and write for her magazines. And Planned Parenthood was totally behind this whole incredible movement for eugenics and forced sterilization and creating a race of superhumans, the Aryan white supremacists, which she believed in and which so many Americans believed in and which the Rockefeller Foundation and the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation were actually pushing during those years. But of course, we don't talk about that today because you see reality are simply dancing shadows projected upon the wall of the cave. What did Margaret Sanger and Adolf Hitler have in common? Why, they were both disciples of Madame Blavatsky. Now, I don't know how many of you know who Madame Blavatsky was, but she was a mystic who, in 1875, organized an organization known as the Theosophical Society. And the Theosophical Society was an organization dedicated to the concept that God, the God of the Bible, was a fraud, and that the real God of this earth was Lucifer. And actually, by twisting reality, she was able to encourage large numbers of people to go along with the idea of a ruling elite and working towards a world government. She started in 1875, died in 1891, but her work was then picked up by Annie Besant, who came from the British Fabian Socialist Society and moved right over into the occult, and then followed by Alice Bailey in the 1920s, Alice Bailey, telling us how the numbers 666 are really sacred numbers and what a wonderful person Lucifer really was. He's just got a bad knock from these terrible, terrible, terrible Christians. And so these ideas of Luciferianism really energized Adolf Hitler. And if you read Adolf Hitler in the Third Reich, you'll find going a great deal into the spiritual background of the New Age and occult movement, because the New Age is not new. It is simply a revival of ancient paganism going back many, many thousands of years. In fact, it is the world's second oldest religion, as Whittaker Chambers said so well. It was whispered beneath the branches of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil during the early days of creation, ye shall be as gods. And Adolf Hitler and Margaret Sanger wanted to remake the world and destroy those inferior people. And if you read Margaret Sanger's writings, and we've outlined it in this little pamphlet we put out, Margaret Sanger talked about Christians. And of course, there was nothing she had more disdain for than Christians. She talked, of course, about eliminating the Negroes. And the masses of Negroes, particularly in the South, still breed carelessly and disastrously, with the result that they increase even far more than the whites, and it's from the portion of the population least intelligent and fit. And then she went on to talk about her Negro project, and she said the most successful educational approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We don't want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population, and the minister. The minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members. Margaret Sanger, whose organization today gets $250 million from the American government to continue her process of worldwide genocide. And as she went on, she began talking about how fundamentalists and Catholics, in addition to blacks, Hispanics, and American Indians, really have to be exterminated. And then she finally concluded with birth control appeals to the advanced radical because it's calculated to undermine the authority of the Christian churches. I look forward to seeing humanity free someday of the tyranny of Christianity, no less than that of capitalism. Well, of course, these ideas did not die at all with Margaret Sanger. They lived on among the people who felt and believed as she did. And of course, one of the most prolific writers of those was a man named Bertrand Russell. And Bertrand Russell really wrote extensively about the fact that really war and famine could not kill enough people. And in 1953, in a book he wrote, which we refer to in this little pamphlet, he pointed out that the only thing that was really going to serve their purpose was to have a black death come every generation. And it would just kill off enough people that then we could go ahead and reproduce as we wanted to. And of course, this would produce a lot of suffering, but suffering really wasn't important to high-minded people, especially when it was the suffering of others. But did you ever hear Bertrand Russell quoted by Barbara Walters or Dan Rather or Tom Brokaw? And you'll find these sources of all the documentation here, and we have all of this. You'll find that in 1989, a man named David Graeber, who's a research biologist employed by the National Park Service, wrote and said, you know, human happiness, and this comes from the Los Angeles Times book review section, October 22nd, 1989. Human happiness and certainly human fecundity are not as important as the wild and healthy planet. I know social scientists who remind us that people are part of nature, but it isn't true. We've become a plague upon ourselves and upon the earth until such time as Homo sapiens should decide to rejoin nature. Some of us can only hope for the right virus to come along. Well, the right virus has come along. It's working just great. Michael Fox, vice president of the American Humane Society, said mankind's the most dangerous, destructive, selfish, and unethical animal on the earth. And of course, the Club of Rome, First Global Revolution, one of their publications, talked about searching for a new enemy to unite humanity. And they came up with the idea of pollution or the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like. But all these dangers are caused by human intervention. And the real enemy, then, is humanity itself. Jacques Cousteau. You've all seen Jacques Cousteau on television. You know, that great humanitarian who's out there guarding the seas for the dolphins. But writing in the UNESCO Bulletin in November of 1991, Jacques Cousteau said, the damage people cause to the planet is a function of demographics. It's equal to the degree of development. One American burdens the earth much more than 20 Bangladeshis. This is a terrible thing to say, but in order to stabilize the world population, we must eliminate 350,000 people a day. It's a horrible thing to say, but it's really much worse not to say it. Negative population control growth comes out of Teaneck, New Jersey. We've interviewed the people on our radio program. They want to get America's population down to 150 million. What are they going to do with the other 125 million? And they want to get the world population down to 2 billion. What are they going to do with all the rest of the other three and a half billion people? At the Gorbachev conference held in San Francisco, in November of 1996. Dr. Sam Keen, who's a New Age philosopher, spoke in one of the workshops, and he talked about the problems of world population. And he said, you know, if we could just get the world population down, if we could do away with 90% of the world's population, there just wouldn't be enough people left around to do that much damage. If we could just do away with 90% of the world's population, he wants to get the world population down to about 500 million people. And if you journey to Elberton, Georgia, to behold the great Druid monument that is built there to honor the age of reason, the Enlightenment, the idea that there is no God of the Bible, but that this indeed is man's plan to create a utopian society. Point number one of the 10 guides, the 10 commandments that come from the dark side. Get the world population down to 500 million. Just about exactly what Dr. Sam Keen was suggesting at the Gorbachev conference last year. And of course, if you read Environmental Overkill by Dixie Lee Ray, they quote Ted Turner. He wants to get the world population down to 200 million. And of course, he just wants enough people around to be able to take care of him and Jane and the lifestyle that they've become acquainted. What most people cannot understand is that abortion and the move towards abortion has had a dramatic impact upon the entire world. And we have forced this onto communities. We used funds, for instance, we'll go into in towns in India or in Indonesia and we'll say, if everybody gets sterilized, we'll put a well in and you'll have water. And of course, anybody who doesn't get sterilized, of course, is a barrier to people getting a well or getting a roadway in. And we've dramatically been able to cut back on world population by using techniques like that. In India, they had forced sterilization. In fact, that's why Indira Gandhi's son lost a political power over there, was because of the forced sterilization. They just go and drag men and women in and forcibly sterilize them. They do this in China, and we fund this. Did you ever wonder why? In America today, you can't give a 12-year-old girl an aspirin without parental consent, but you can take her down and get an abortion for her? It has to do with this whole world population control movement and the fact that there are people out there that look at the world entirely differently than you and I. Homosexuality. Let me point out that if you read what the population control people have been saying, and we have a book, I don't think we have it with us, but we can give you the reference to it. We carry it. It's one of the books we carry. Freedom on the Altar. It simply quotes from the population control meetings where they talk about, we've got to encourage homosexuality. Why? Well, because they die young. And secondly, they don't reproduce. Isn't that wonderful? What sort of perverted mind could want to encourage people into this lifestyle? Because most of the people are not gay. They're unhappy. And many of them are very nice people, but they have a compulsive sexual addiction. They don't know what to do. And so they're trapped within it. Within the last 2 years, and we have these articles, if you'd like to get them, they want to challenge anything we say, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal. It simply pointed out that on the great university campuses across America, the homosexual studies, the gay and lesbian studies, the transsexual studies, the women's studies, they're all being funded by the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie Foundations. The entire homosexual movement is being pushed and encouraged by American establishment. I have a letter I recently received from a gay doctor. He'd read my book, AIDS, The Unnecessary Epidemic, which is the best book on the politics of AIDS available. We've been blocked at every turn, but we've got over 20,000, probably 23, 24,000 copies out across America telling you the true story, and that is we're not trying to stop this epidemic. But he wrote to me and he said, do you think for 1 minute that the homosexuals would have the power in America that they have today if it wasn't that the government wanted them to have that power? And when the government takes away their power, they're going to be destroyed. He's absolutely right, and they're not smart enough to realize that. If you read the homosexual magazines, as I do, The Advocate, you'll find that there are homosexuals who are writing in and say, don't you realize that our leadership's been taken over by the radical left, and what they're doing is manipulating us to hate Christians, and then they're manipulating Christians to hate us. Don't you understand what's happening? But I don't know how many of them really do understand, because they think they're on the winning side and they're dying at a frightening number. Not only that, but about 1 out of 3 lesbians comes down with breast carcinoma, but they very carefully suppress that information because they don't want the public to know. One of the most interesting things has been the recent work that's been done on breast carcinoma. and the relationship between first trimester abortions and breast carcinoma. And there was a recent review with what they call a meta-analysis, where they took 21 articles that appeared in the world literature, and 18 of those showed a very definite relationship between first trimester abortions and breast carcinoma. So what happens? Immediately, the American Medical Association, the American Cancer Association are attacking this article. And of course, ordinarily, to get an article published in a peer review publication takes years. They immediately smashed one through. The New England Journal of Medicine came out within the last few weeks, a summary in Denmark that is so flawed and fallacious that anybody who reads it, who understands anything about statistics, will understand they're comparing apples and oranges, anything to prevent people and women from realizing that when they have an abortion, it's not only that they're killing a child, they may very well be killing themselves. And you would think the American Cancer Society would want to stop cancer. No, that's not part of the agenda. Abortion is what it's all about, and keeping the population under control. There's a doctor in Texas who's come up with something. It's anti-neoplastins. It's an anti-cancer product. And he's been using this for a number of years, and it really works. He's taken patients that have, you know, been to all sorts of other doctors. They're written off. They're going to die. They got brain cancers. And a significant number of these he's cured. And he has a license to give out the medicine in Texas. Well, some of these patients took the medicine across state borders, and you know what that means. Even the people now who are indicting him say, well, you know, even good doctors do bad things. They acknowledge that what he's doing is good and helping people, and he's not making money on this. He's not in this for money. He's trying to stop cancer. And what's the government doing? They're going to shut him down. Why? Because cancer kills off the population, and as horrible as that may seem, and as tragic it may seem, we have wicked and evil forces at work within our society. Probably one of the greatest charades of all time was the outlawing of DDT in 1972. It all started with a book called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson. And in the foreword to that book, if you read it, she quotes Albert Schweitzer saying, mankind is going to destroy himself. And the inference is, of course, Albert Schweitzer was saying mankind, because of destruction of the environment and the use of pesticides, is going to destroy himself. And she even gives the quotation where she got it from. But what Albert Schweitzer was talking about was nuclear weapons, not the environment. But of course, she used this to begin to kick off the major campaign to do away with DDT. And for a period of about 12 years, we were besieged with articles almost on a daily basis about how DDT was softening the shells of birds, entering the food chain. We were all going to die. The fish were going to die. The birds were going to die. The insects were going to die. DDT was the safest insecticide ever known to mankind. In fact, we simply quote Alexander King of the Club of Rome, where he says, you know, my quarrel with DDT wasn't the fact it didn't work, but that it worked too well in Guyana. It simply destroyed malaria within a period of 2 years. And the population kept growing, people kept being born, and nobody was dying off. So my quarrel was not at all with the fact that it wasn't effective, but the fact it worked too well. I have a wonderful interview back there in our population control set with Professor G. Gordon Edwards, who is a professor of biology at San Jose State University, who led the battle across America on DDT. And he pointed out, for instance, when they tell you about the pelicans dying off, the reason the pelicans died was because there was an oil spill around their little island where they were nesting. And so the environmentalists went out, or the scientists went out, and they picked up 80% of the eggs. And they said, look, there are very, very few new pelicans hatching the next year. Well, of course there were very few new pelicans, because they'd taken all the eggs out to examine them. He pointed out that the studies that were done on eggshells were done by giving birds DDT, but not giving them any calcium in their controlled diet. And sure enough, the eggshells were soft. The article was published in Nature magazine. And when he wrote to the scientist who'd done it and said, why don't you repeat it and give them calcium? And they did. And the eggshells were not only as equally hard, they were harder. But you know, Nature magazine refused to publish that article because they said, we will never publish an article that is favorable to DDT. And that's the way that was handled for 12 years. Now, in a period of about 20 years, DDT had saved about 500 million lives from insect-transmitted diseases. And since we have outlawed DDT worldwide, probably 500 to 600 million people have died needlessly around the world. One of the greatest frauds of all time, and we document the source of the material. We have the essay that's written by Professor Edwards. It's very, very convincing. We've checked out many of his sources. But you see, you're never to hear this. 500 to 600 billion people. Have any idea how many 747s that have to go down at 400 people on it to come up with 600 million people, 500 million people? An awful lot of 747s going down. But you see, this is part of the planned program. And he simply quotes from the people on the other side who said, this all has to do with population control. There are too many people in the world. And they didn't care that some of the new insecticides that they were going to have to use were going to be much more dangerous, because as Professor Worthen, I believe it is, Worthen, who we quote in here, said, after all, most of those people are just blacks and Hispanics anyway. It's only they that are going to bear the brunt of the new, more dangerous insecticides that we're going to be using. Drugs. Drugs are coming into America from all over the world. Now, we have satellites up in the sky that can read a newspaper, that can read a license plate. And you mean to tell me, with the technology that we have, we cannot tell where the drugs are coming into this country? I can give you the name of at least a dozen books written by people from the far right and the far left that point out that the American government is involved in bringing drugs into this country. Why? Well, drugs coming into the country serve a number of very useful purposes. Number one, it gives the government the opportunity to have a war on drugs so that they can start watching your bank account. And if you take more than $10,000 out of your bank account over a year period, even if it's in three or four withdrawals of $2,500 each, suddenly you are guilty of structuring. You're trying to keep the government knowing what you're doing with your money, and obviously you must be a drug user. Now, then of course we have forfeiture laws in the name, of course, of fighting drugs. They can come in and take... Well, it doesn't even have to be fighting drugs. There was some woman whose husband solicited a prostitute and was in their car, and they took the car away, and it happened to belong to the wife, but that didn't matter. What does soliciting a prostitute have to do with drugs and forfeiture? Suddenly, we have given the government the ability to massively expand its control. I wonder how many of you remember the story of the opium wars. They were fought between Britain and China during the last century. How many of you believe that those wars were fought to stop opium from being brought in? They were being brought to allow opium to be brought in because a nation that is involved in the use of drugs is not going to be concerned with these abstract ideas of liberty and freedom. And of course, IV drug users usually get diseases, hepatitis, AIDS, they die off. The incidence of death among the IV drug users, I dealt with them when I was working at county hospitals across America. IV drug users, they're tragic, tragic victims. And we are actively encouraging this. And whether you read the books by or see young man back here had compromised by Terry Reed. I've had Terry Reed on my program many times. He's got 100 and some odd people who've been involved in this. He's given the names to everybody, at the Congress in Los Angeles. They were going to have that investigation down here. These are all whitewashes. The last thing they want you to understand is what they are really up to. Drugs are such an effective means of helping with the population control agenda. I mean, the example after example after example we can give you of how they've done this. I don't know how many of you remember the story of the Tuskegee study where they recruited 400 blacks in 1932 into a study to treat their syphilis. Only they weren't going to treat their syphilis. They were going to let them die. And for 40 years, between 1932 and 1972, they let the syphilis that they had go untreated, telling them all the time they were being treated and lying to them so that they could follow its progress and infect their wives and infect their children. And finally, when a reporter got hold of the story and blasted it out across America, they had to hush it up and they stopped the study. And of course, they paid off with a small amount of money the blacks and their wives and their children. But how many people heard that story? Do you think they would have done it if they'd been whites? This is the mentality that hates blacks. And yet they are unique creations made in the very image and likeness of God, just like you and I. And where is the public outcry? And of course, the outcry is deafening in its silence. When, during the early parts of the AIDS epidemic, it was known that blood transfusions could transmit the disease, there was a meeting was held in Atlanta, Georgia, in January of 1983, where the blood banks were called together. And we're told this disease. We don't know what's causing it, but it's transmitted by blood. You can actually stop 80% of the transmission simply by doing a hepatitis B core antigen test, and you know, but you should do this, and do not give the blood if it's hepatitis B antigen positive, because if you do, you're taking a chance on giving people this deadly disease. Not only it was in the blood, but it was in the cryoprecipitate that was being given to hemophiliacs. So what happened? The American Red Cross got together with all of the other blood banks and said, look, if we all hang together, we can't be criticized. We know it's in there, and we know a lot of these people are going to die, but it'll be cheaper just to pay them off, and maybe we won't even have to pay them off down the line. And actually, those memos are all available in a book called Bad Blood by Judith Reitman, just come out. Judith is trying to get this story out across America. She has been blocked from every major television and every major radio program, and fortunately, Radio Liberty put her on, and I'm sure a few other courageous people across America put her on. The American Red Cross is desperate to get this story stopped because they intentionally killed thousands of people with blood that they knew they were infected, and now they're beating their rap with the help of the federal courts. A few cases, of course, have been settled out of court, and they always seal it so that nobody could ever talk about what I'm talking about tonight. Not only that, but the Hemophiliac Association, dedicated to preserving the lives of hemophiliacs, or maybe not dedicated to preserving the lives of hemophiliacs, because it's largely funded in part by our great foundations. And they were telling the hemophiliacs to go ahead and use it. It's perfectly safe. Don't listen to these people who are telling you it's infected. And we infected 90% of the severe hemophiliacs in America. About 50% of the hemophiliacs overall, but of those people with a severe bleeding deficiency. But you see, if we believe in genetic engineering, if once we kill these people off, then there won't be any more hemophiliacs. And it was done the same thing in France, but at least in France they put the man responsible in prison. And they're putting them in prison in Japan. But in America, oh well, you know, we just don't want to talk about those things. Bad Blood by Judith Reitman, she documents everything I've said, and I know it's accurate because I've talked to the people who have actually seen these documents personally before she ever did this. She's been threatened, her life's been threatened, she's a professional writer. I think she's just sort of an average liberal, moderate individual, and suddenly the whole life is coming cascading down in front of her because she had the courage to write a book after being threatened by the American Red Cross, which of course was headed by Elizabeth Dole. Well, we could go on and give you example after example. I think we can certainly talk about how vaccines have been used. Now, there's a great deal of controversy about vaccines. I personally believe that some of the vaccines have done a wonderful, wonderful job. I mean, as a physician here in America, I never saw polio. I went to Africa. The polio vaccine was delayed in being given there, and so much destruction from it. Now, it may well be that some of the polio vaccine that was given in America contained monkey viruses, the SV40, the simian virus. It may very well be that this is tied in to how the AIDS epidemic was spread, but the idea behind the vaccine was certainly worthwhile. On the other hand, it may be that we've created a horrible, horrible monster with the polio vaccine. But certainly the diphtheria and tetanus vaccines have been wonderful here in the United States. Pertussis vaccine was not good, and they kept pushing this anyway. There were a lot of disasters because of it. They've come up with a new genetically engineered pertussis vaccine, which I think will be ever so much safer. Certainly the smallpox, the cowpox vaccine, has done away with smallpox. These have been wonderful, wonderful, wonderful things. But when you can't trust the vaccine industry, then what do you do? In the Philippines, and in certain parts of South America, women in the childbearing age were offered free tetanus vaccinations. The idea being they wanted to stop neonatal tetanus. In other words, children can get the umbilical cord infected with tetanus and they can die of tetanus. So they wanted to immunize, but only women, and only during those childbearing years. And so they vaccinated free of charge all these women. Now, ordinarily, when you give tetanus vaccine, you only have to give two shots or three shots at the most. They gave these women five shots. And so some curious, suspicious nun over in the Philippines got hold of some of these vaccine bottles and had them analyzed, and they had a corrigonadotropin in them. And what it was an anti-birth, was an aborting vaccine. And they put a choriogonadotropin in, tied it to the tetanus vaccine, and suddenly the woman becomes sensitive to her own reproductive hormones so that she can no longer give birth. Now, have you heard about this from Barbara Walters? And of course, this is the sort of thing that's being covered up. We are dealing with evil and wicked people. But they have a plan, and they have a plan for you and I. Barbara Marx Hubbard is one of the most wealthy women in America today. She's the heiress to the Marx toy fortune. And Barbara Marx Hubbard actually ran in the Democratic primary for the vice presidency against Geraldine Ferraro. Fortunately, Geraldine won, and then, of course, their ticket lost. But, of course, she comes from the same bolt of cloth that Al Gore comes from. But Barbara Marx Hubbard, in a book she wrote called The Book of Co-Creation, The Revelation, talks about the channeled message that she got from the occult forces that dominate and control her life. Now, in the current copy of her book, which you can get at your local occult or metaphysical bookstore, this quotation will not be found. It comes from the New American, and I checked out the source of it. It comes from Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and I have the original manuscript, but they were a little... They thought this might bother the Christians in our population, and so they really didn't want to upset us very much. But Barbara Marx Hubbard has a revelation about the book of Revelations. And so she takes verse for verse by verse, and she tells what the occult or demonic forces that are speaking to her say. Now, if you read Revelations 6:8, the statement is this: I looked, and there before me was a pale horse. Its rider was named Death, and Hades was following close behind him. They were given power over a fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, and plague, and by the wild beasts of the earth. That comes the NIV version. But Barbara Marx Hubbard rewrote it this way: out of the full specter of human personality, one fourth is electing to transcend. One fourth is destructive, and the defective seeds. In the past, they were permitted to die a natural death. Now, as we approach the quantum shift from the creature human to the co-creative human, the human who is an inheritor of godlike powers, the destructive one-fourth must be eliminated from the social body. Fortunately, you're not responsible for that act. We are. We are in charge of God's selective process for planet Earth. He selects, we destroy. We are the riders of the pale horse. Barbara Marx Hubbard, Democrat candidate for the vice presidency in the primary, one of the leaders of the New Age movement, the creation, the book of Revelation. Ladies and gentlemen, these people intend to depopulate the Christian element of this society. Some of you have heard Mark Kornke. Carolee Bixman will be interviewing her on our program, and she's certainly looking across America. There are concentration camps out there. You have to understand these are formed under FEMA, and we are told they are there in case of a national emergency, in case there was unrest in the inner cities and those nasty black people were rising up and demonstrating, or there were people who felt that we were trying to take us into a new world order, and these people were creating unrest in the society. I have no question at all that the same mentality, the same spiritual forces are at work in America today that dominated Adolf Hitler during the Holocaust. You need to get Hitler and the New Age. It's a fascinating book, and you'll see the similarities so much between what happened in Adolf Hitler's Germany and what is transpiring in Bill Clinton and Al Gore's America today. But don't think that it is simply the Democrats. We have these same forces within the Republican Party, and Newt Gingrich is a New Ager. We have bipartisan treason. We have bipartisan betrayal. And you must understand that behind everything that's going on today, there are dark and sinister spiritual forces. James Russell Lowell, writing back in the 1840s, talking about the crisis of slavery that faced America at that time, said this: once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In that strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side, then it is the brave man chooses while the coward stands aside until the multitudes make virtue of the faith they have denied. Though the cause of evil prospers, yet his truth alone is strong, though a portion be the scaffold and upon the throne be wrong. But that scaffold sways the future, for in the dim unknown, standeth God within the shadows, keeping watch above his own. We are engaged today in a spiritual war. Most people don't understand this, but we're told in Ephesians 6, for we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the forces of the darkness of this earth. Wherefore, put ye on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. And that's what we're told to do. Some Christian ministries tell you, well, God's coming tomorrow. Isn't it wonderful? You're all going to be whisked away in a cloud. And I don't believe that. I believe it may come sometime, but I don't think it's going to happen tomorrow. I don't know when it's going to happen. And wouldn't it be terrible if we lost America in 20 or 30 or 40 years from now? Why, the rapture came. Wouldn't it be terrible as far as our children and our children's children? I would remind you of that quotation. On the fields of hesitation bleached the bones of many millions who at a time of crisis hesitated, and because they hesitated, they lost, and because they lost, they died. We have an obligation to be involved in this battle, this spiritual battle which is being played out here before our very eyes at this time. And so I ask you, first of all, if you don't have a personal relationship with the Lord, that you try to get in touch with somebody who can get you going in that direction. Because let me tell you, if you try to get involved in this battle on your own, you're going to be destroyed. I've seen this happen to too many people. You need to be on the right terms with the Lord, and then you need to commit yourself in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation under God, or any nation so conceived, can long endure, or, as Abraham Lincoln feared, shall perish from the earth. So thank you so very much. You get up and stretch, and then if you have some questions, well, I would love to answer them for you.